Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really fantastic founder, you know, a founder that has done it many times and with a lot of success. You know, every single, you know, time around that he starts a company, he comes with a hit, with a nice outcome. So he's become an expert baseball player, I would say, you know, when it comes to being a startup founder, because every time, you know, he gets the ball, he hits it out of the park. But again, today we're going to be talking about, you know, the building, the scaling, the financing, the exiting. So all of that good stuff that we like to hear. But then we're going to be talking about how to jump, you know, into an opportunity where you see larger corporates that are maybe looking, you know, for it. Also, you know, how to create something, you know, out of perhaps, you know, like a problem that you are seeing, as well as, you know, how to really think about the origin stories and how to start to really build a foundation of what could be, you know, a really meaningful business. Again, brace yourself for a very inspiring episode. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Rami Tamir. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So originally born in startup land, but in this case, it was in Nazareth. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
It was a small city. Same city as Jesus was born in. So that's a good starting point. But in reality, it's a really small town up in the north. Very, very quiet life, I'd say.
So in your case, as anything, you know, in Israel, you need to go to the army. You know, for you, it was 5 years. I'm wondering, what do you think the army gave you, you know, in terms of discipline? And I mean, I've seen that a lot, you know, working out very well for folks. What do you think, you know, it was the positive, you know, factors that you took from that experience with you?
This is a great question. And I can see it today with younger people, but you kind of starting the army with a young person just off of high school. And within a year, in my case, you command people. And you're kind of in charge of people's life. It kind of gives you instant maturity, instant responsibility. Responsibility in the army is something that is complete. There's no excuses. You either get the job done, you don't get the job done. So that's something that sobers you very, very fast. You get to grow fast and you have to make decisions in split seconds and kind of optimize for decision-making rather than, you know, being wrong or right. Obviously, it's better if you're right, but you have to optimize for, you know, for when you make the decision so nothing waits. The combination of all of that and actually working with great people, because in the army, you get to meet kind of the top people. It's an amazing experience. It's hard. It's not easy. But at the end of the day, you go from 0 to 100 in about a few months, which is amazing.
So for you going from 0 to 100, you know, I guess also software, you know, thinking about scale and thinking about problems, that's what you study. Why software out of all things?
To be honest, it was random. Back then, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just left the army. I was trying to figure out what to do. And my brother was going in that direction. I say, hey, you know what? Maybe it's something for me as well. So basically what I did is I picked the hardest thing to get into in the university. And I said, worst case, if I don't like it, I'll just, you know, go down in the list. And I really, really liked it. It was like a match for me made in heaven. I enjoy solving problems. And apparently that's what you do when you do software on a daily basis, all the time. So that's what I do till this day. And it was like, yeah, for me, it was an instant love.
And obviously, that's what you do too in the venture world. I mean, in your case, your first gig was working for a startup, you know, and you guys went from like 5 employees to like 200 in no time. But what picked your curiosity about smaller companies versus, you know, going more like the larger corporation, you know, route?
Again, there's not a lot of large corporation in Israel. Back then, it was very little. Coming from the army, I really like small outfits. You can influence, you can learn, you can look sideways and know what's going on. It's not something that is hard to understand. So I gravitated towards small companies. And the first company was someone I knew kind of said, hey, are you interested in joining us? I said, yeah, sure. And we started working from basement of a house in a small town here in, around Tel Aviv. It was amazing. Yeah, we grew from 5 people to 200 people because the technology was like amazing. But as amazing was our lack of understanding of business. So we knew nothing. I wasn't a founder there. I was an engineer. I kind of promoted very fast. Didn't know how to manage, but I found myself managing people very fast. But as fast as we grew, we shrunk down because we realized we have no clue of how to make a business out of it, how to make it kind of something that sticks. And it's something that I still carry because I think the technology was amazing. Interestingly enough, we were trying to do something very similar to what YouTube is now, but back when there were only modems. And the bandwidth was not great, so we had to develop amazing technology to get there. End of the day, nothing was ready for something like that.
Well, I mean, in your case, after that experience, you went at it with consulting. For how long did you do consulting before you realized that there was an opportunity that made sense to serve people like Cisco?
So I decided to do some consulting after this gig because I wanted to kind of clear my head, try to understand, am I ready to actually start something on my own or should I join another opportunity? So I had a lot of assets coming from that company. So I just spent 6 months working with companies, coding, helping them develop around video networking. That was my strength. It was great, but it was boring. Because when you're a consultant, what you get to do end of the day is the non-core things. You get to do what the companies kind of wants to bring up very fast, and usually you have to hand it over very fast. So after 6 months, although it was very lucrative, I made a lot of money out of it, but I decided it's not for me. And back then I met with my partner until today, Benny Schneider, and we started our first company together. The first company was around networking.
I like, you know, in here, the quote of Richard Branson that says that the ideas, they're like buses. You got to make sure you get in the right bus, right? Before the door closes. Now, in your case, the way that you guys went about that is you seized the opportunity. And I want to talk about the way that you guys went about that, because literally, you know, in this case, it was a really fast, you know, type of cycle from point A all the way to point C with Pentacom. So how did that, you know, journey? How was that journey of really seeing the opportunity and being like, let's go? Because this was also your very first business that you were co-founding. So walk us through that.
So we started out doing something else. We wanted to do kind of, if you know what packet processor is, back then it was all the rage. So we set out to do that. It was starting, people talked about it. That was interesting. And, you know, when you start a new company, you're going to people and you pitch the idea, you get feedback, you morph. One of the places we went to get feedback, obviously, was Cisco, because Cisco back then, I'm not sure if people know that today. Cisco back then was what, I don't know, Apple is today or Google, or it was a giant, amazing business. So they say, yeah, this is interesting, but we have something more interesting. We are working on something new. And if you're interested, actually join and develop a component in that. That'll be very interesting for us, but it's up to you. So seizing the opportunity is daunting, because what we had to do is come up with, it was starting with hardware, develop a whole hardware, a whole chassis, two type of line cards in speeds that were not common back then. And Cisco was coming up with a line of products in a year. So we had a year actually kind of go ahead and bring that to market, because if you miss the bus, they'll have to come up with another solution. So we decided, you know what, we'll put the other idea aside. I'll tell you what happened with it later on. And we're going all in. All in meant actually doing all of that development in a year. Towards the end, we worked in shifts to actually make that happen. And I think in 2 quarters after we shipped the first product, we covered all the cost of the company. It was an amazing success, and Cisco picked us up, and we became part of Cisco. And by the way, our original idea, one of the other founders took it, created a company out of it, and it was sold after a few years to Cisco as well.
Wow. So this was your first rodeo, really, on the M&A side, right? Like getting the company acquired. How was that, you know, that moment where you guys received the phone call, you know, from Cisco and really developing that all the way to the finish line, to the acquisition crystallizing?
Yeah, nerve-wracking, because everything can go wrong. But back then, Cisco was really, really proficient in acquiring company and assimilating it. I haven't seen such efficiency since. It's something that they kind of built and mastered. So that was cool for me. And later on, when I was in Cisco, one of my roles as someone who was acquired, helping other companies who were acquired to get assimilated, to understand what it means, to walk them through the whole thing. Now, that's something that is, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from that, how to do it properly on the acquiring side and on the acquired side. There's a lot of things can go wrong in an acquisition. Most acquisitions fail. And it's easy to mess the whole thing up. There's a few things, if you do right, you have better opportunity or better shot at making it correct. But it's hard. It's really hard.
So just to close the loop, you know, it was rumored that it was for about 180 million, obviously not disclosed, but that's what people can see on Crunchbase. So amazing outcome. I guess to this point that you're referencing, what would be the three main ingredients that the founders listening to us should keep in mind when thinking about getting their company acquired based on, you know, what you've seen and also that experience that you were alluding to at Cisco?
I think the first thing is don't think about getting acquired. Because if you think about that, you always think short term. You don't develop your company. The company is not being sold. It's being acquired, if that makes sense. If you have something, someone interested, they'll reach out for you. If you're building a company to get acquired, in most cases, you'll probably fall short because you will not develop your marketing enough. You'll not develop your go-to-market and your sales and everything to do with being a proper company. If you build a proper company, good things will happen. You can decide that you want your moat to be around technology, which helps you get acquired, maybe, depending on the stage. You can do a lot of things to optimize a little bit, but by and large, if you want to have an opportunity for liquidation, any kind of liquidation, just build a proper company. Build it from the ground up to be a proper company. Good things will happen. And you can make a decision about where do you want to take it. You want to take it to an early stage liquidation, longer term, it's up to you. But I think that's the main thing. Don't think about acquisition.
So then in your case, you know, after 5 years, I mean, that was quite a long vesting and resting, as they would say, you know, after you get your company acquired. But 5 years that you spent at Cisco, in this case for you, as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And then you went at it again, you know, with Qumranit. And with Qumranit, I want to hear, like, how do you guys go about really creating something out of the problem that you were seeing? I mean, how did that next chapter happen? Because here's the thing. One thing that I love is that I always say that the beginning needs to start with the end in mind, like really like understanding what's the path, what's the direction. And then you kind of like reverse back engineer the process to where you are now. Obviously, after being, you know, going through an acquisition like you did with Pentacom, being able to be involved with now with Cisco for 5 years, you know, on the acquiring side, you were able to see what worked, what didn't work on many companies. Why did you go at it, you know, this second time again, you know, and why did you think that that problem was meaningful enough for you to take action?
It wasn't about the problem. It's about what you want to do. As I said before, I like solving problems. And early stage startups, you solve more problems a day than any corporate employees solve. I don't know, months, a year, I don't know. You get to solve problems. Some of it's not easy because you have to make a lot of decisions. Most of your decisions fail because you're working against all odds. But I like that atmosphere. I like the, you know, working against the odds, sitting in a room with amazing, smart people trying to solve problems, hard problems. This is what I thrive on. This is what I like. So it was obvious for me that I want to do it again and again and again. So that wasn't a question.
That's incredible. So how was the journey with the Qumranit?
So as the previous one, we started wanting to solve IO kind of solution for modern servers. It took us about 2 to 3 months to realize, more than that, actually six months to realize that the market is not there. Because it's really fragmented. It's going to be hard to go after, create a go-to-market that is coherent enough for a startup to do. So at that point, there's always in every startup, it depends on how honest you are with yourself and you, with your co-founders and with your board. Because the easiest thing to do is kind of say, you know what, let's try some more, try some more, try some more. And at some point, you just find yourself kind of, okay, it's too late to do anything and you're done. So with me and Benny, my partner, is like, we're always brutally honest. We get into a room and trying to figure things out. And after the 6 months, 7 months, we decide, hey, there's a problem here. We need to be honest with ourselves, you know, our investors, and see, you know, if there's something else we can do with what we developed so far. So we did that. It's hard. It's one of the hardest things you have to do, because basically you have to go to your investors and tell them I was wrong. And I need some time to come up with a new idea. Here's the timeline for that, because nobody wants to, as an investor, you don't want to be kind of be open-ended. Here's our plan. Here's how we get there. Is what the assets. So you have to make a very thoughtful plan of how you want to move forward. And the hardest thing, and the thing that kind of worked for us the best, is get your employees involved. We had like back then 15 employees. It's the smartest people you can think of. And if you're not harnessing their brain power, you're basically, you're giving up a lot of power. And most, I've seen founders in that situation trying to keep everything close because they are embarrassed. They're afraid of telling people. They're afraid they will leave. We kind of went the other way. We said, okay, here's the thing. We were wrong. Here's the assets that we have. Let's come up with something else from what we have, from the technology we've built. Let's see what's going on right now. Let's do ideation right now on the job. And we did that. And what we came up with became KVM. So KVM is the kernel-based virtual machine. It's the standard virtualization for Linux. That's the engine that today runs Amazon Cloud and Google Cloud and Oracle Cloud and every cloud you can think of. And we did that because, you know, in a discussion with our engineers, talking about trends, talking about what's going on, talking about what we should do, and we had kernel of the technology for that. We developed that. We were very, very naive about open source. So we said, hey, let's offer it to the Linux kernel. And it was accepted in the Linux kernel 2 weeks after we patched it, which was, everybody thought it was, what, that can never happen. But we were naive, so we didn't know. And from there on, it's still in the Linux kernel. And the company was acquired, I think a year and a half after that, by Red Hat, the open source giant, to be on top of virtualization. So we kind of, out of the problem that we have, we identified a trend or a theme that we can go after. Because we were in the market, we could have identified that in the right architecture. And from that, we actually, from the low point that we were on, we kind of pivoted into something very strong that created an amazing product. And the amazing product is not because of us, it's because the engineers that worked on it did an amazing job.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage,
or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And that acquisition, I believe it was announced for $120 million. One thing that that I want to ask you here is co-founder dynamics, you know, because it sounds that you've been able to really have the opportunity and the luck of meeting, you know, co-founders like Benny, that you haven't done just one, you've done multiple companies with great outcomes. What do you think, you know, like makes your guys' relationship so special?
It's a little bit like marriage. You have to know your strengths and your weaknesses. You have to know to listen. And when not to listen, it's kind of, it's a dynamic that works, but you have to want to make that work. Usually founders have a lot of egos, and we have egos, but we know that when we walk into a room and we have to solve a problem, we have to put it aside and create some sort of a framework to making decisions. And it helps a lot that we are both engineers. Engineering culture, it's about kind of the merits of the idea, not who suggested it, who did that, who's doing what. It's about that. So it's always easy. It's kind of, think about it as a prolonged design review. We go over things, we solve things. There's always ups and downs in that. But the fact that, you know, we've been through some hardships and successes, we know where our strengths and our weaknesses, and they're different. We complete each other. We're not the same person. Helps a lot. And yeah, I think it's unique because I've been in boards. I'm sitting on boards because I'm doing angel investments. I've seen companies that went under because the founders did not get along, because they didn't manage to actually solve their problems. They put their problems ahead of the company's issue or the success of the companies. And it's the first thing that will drive the company to the ground is if the founders are, you know, having a hard time working with each other. Yeah, that's a bust.
Now, obviously, at this point, two companies, two exits. You know, as they say, once you're lucky, twice you're good. Yeah. The problem that I've seen is that when you realize that, your confidence can go out of the roof and you can drink your own Kool-Aid, right? And with your next company, Ravelo, you know, actually, arguably, you know, it's rumored, you know, in the $500 million outcome, but amazing, you know, success story, you know, a company that got acquired by Oracle. How did you guys go about, you know, just not being too overconfident, just like really understanding what that next chapter would be and also walk us through that journey as well?
So I can tell you that's, for me, it's not a problem being overconfident. Once you start a startup, you're paranoid for a reason because you're going up against so many things that can go wrong. And by the way, in Ravelo, we picked up and decided to do a technology that we know for a fact that IBM and Cisco failed to develop similar technology. They tried. We knew that. But we thought we can do that, not because of confidence, because the way we start a company, by the way, is we put our own money in and spend 6 months trying to figure out if we know what we're doing in terms of market, in terms of technology, in terms of, you know, how we want to build it. So we did that in Ravelo, and after 3 to 4 months, we realized, hey, there's something there. I think we can do that. Obviously, we underestimated the effort as always, but it worked, and it worked well. So it's not about overconfidence. In the journey, you're paranoid for a good reason. I think that the worst thing being a repeat entrepreneur is that you're not on, it's not on edge, but you're not getting panicked by things that happen. You kind of, you've seen it before, so you're not panicking. The fact is you're not panicking sometimes can get the whole organization into some kind of lull. Everybody thinks, hey, it's going to be okay. They'll solve it. So that's, I think, the biggest risk for a repeat or a successful entrepreneur is that sense of comfort. So it's less about the confidence, it's more about the comfort. And it's a problem. You know, it's something that I keep thinking about. I remember the rush of getting panicked in the early days. Today, I'm not panicking anymore. I'm trying to create that, but it's not there. So you find ways to overcome that, create that, you know, that atmosphere. Hey, things need to change. We need to do something else. The feel of electricity in the air.
So then tell us about Ravelo. How was that experience for you guys?
It was amazing. So there's an interesting story there, by the way, actually. Our first customer in Ravelo was a cloud virtualization technology. We offered companies, it was in the stage where companies seriously looked into the cloud, but they did not have cloud application for enterprises because everything was on-prem for them. So we created a way for this application to live in the cloud without knowing that they're on the cloud. A lot of technology to get. Our first customer out of the gate was $1 million a year customer. Like, first time we saw. It was obviously, hey, we're amazing. We kind of cracked the go-to-market. Now let's figure out how to duplicate this one. And for a year, we could not duplicate that customer. We looked on the verticals, on the technology, on everything that we could not. It turned out that customer was a unicorn in terms of how applicable it was for our technology. So what happened in the meantime is our sales org started selling. And you know how salespeople work. They go after the least resistant path. So they found this and they found that, and they found small use cases that didn't mature into the numbers that we talked about, but end of the day started to create a real business out of it. And the real business grew. So after a year of trying to duplicate, we abandoned that customer, not abandoned the customer, but abandoned that use case, and used the use case that the salespeople brought in and made a success out of that. And at that point, Oracle approached us. And it made sense to join their cloud business unit. We were acquired by Oracle.
And the rest is history. So Salto, you know, your latest baby, and let's spend some time on your latest baby. I can see your face lighting up when the name of Salto comes up. So tell us about the origin story of Salto.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So in Ravelo, it was a SaaS product. The SaaS product was connected to Salesforce, Marketo, and maybe another one. And you know how it is with SaaS. You develop software, you release it often, you try to release it on a weekly basis, maybe a few times a week. And on the software side, we were doing great. Kind of, obviously, you make mistakes, you fix it, you know what's going on. You always know what's going on. That's the nice thing about the software methodology as it evolved till today. But we had, as I said, Salesforce and Marketo connected to the product. They were part of the product. So everything we had to do on the parallel side on Salesforce, Marketo was like, always like, didn't work. We could not get a handle of things. It was slow. It was slowing things down. Nothing was working properly. And back then I kind of figured out, hey, we don't know how to work with these platforms. These are platforms for large organization. At some point they have to figure it out. I don't have time right now. Let's hack it. So we hacked it. We did all kind of crazy things to make it work. It was a source of a lot of tension internally. And after we acquired, kind of, once after I left Oracle, I started looking to that, say, hey, what went on there? What was the problem? Why did we face those issues? What's the right way of doing that? Started talking to people in the industry. And what I realized this is not our problem. This is not about not being professional or being a small company or anything. That's a problem. SaaS applications are configuration. This is something that they're doing on a daily basis. There are hundreds of changes going to these SaaS platforms on a daily and monthly basis, are done in a very manual way, error-prone, not systematic, in a cadence that doesn't match what we used to in software delivery. So for me, it was, we're engineers. If we can bring that solution to that problem, we may have something. So we spent some time, we started the company, put our own money, spent some time seeing if we can develop a technology for that. And we came with what Salto is. Kind of a way to extract the configuration, kind of construct it in a text format and take the whole route of software delivery as it was developed in the last 2 to 3 decades in the software side to to SaaS applications. And obviously, because we were looking for challenges, we said we want to do that for all SaaS platforms. So we developed some sort of an engine that can handle all of them, spend a lot of time in technology on this. And this is what we have right now. We support something like 20 and growing number of SaaS. And we have everything that I talked about right now. If I could talk to Rami back then, I could offer him, hey, here's a solution for you. It can connect to everything. It can do whatever you hoped it, it will do. So that's what we think is out there.
So I guess for the people listening, how do you guys make money? What's the business model?
So we go after IT departments. So we have three types of SaaS application that we support. One is business applications, Salesforce, NetSuite, similar. The other one is IT application, Jira, Zendesk, Google Workspace, etc. And the third one, which is an exciting one because, again, we stumbled on it like 6 months ago, it was security applications. Because if you do proper change management in security application, I mean like Okta and Microsoft, Entra and Jump and Intune and a bunch of others. If you do proper change management for a security application, for security SaaS, that's the first stage of security because you know who's done what. You're analyzing the configuration. You can revert the change. You can back up everything. You have full monitor and audit trail of every change that happened. You can go back. So that's the first stage of security. From there on, you can take a look at the configuration. We look at all configuration, we understand it, know what's related to what. We can offer fixes to a misconfiguration and avoid security holes on the development end of things before it hits production. So lots of benefits for that. So the way we make money, we go to the IT departments of these applications and we offer them that. And for most of them, that translates into efficiency, translate into reducing the tech debt on this platform, getting to a point where you have enough feature velocity in your Salesforce means money for the company because that's where the business is. And for every of those SaaS applications. And that works. It's hard because this is a new category. But end of the day, once you're in, we have a saying internally that says they always come back. When someone is exposed to the idea, it can take them a month, 2 months, three, sometimes a year, sometimes two years. But at some point, they come back and say, hey, we need that now. And this is something really, really powerful. I don't have to explain the pain or anything. It's just about, hey, here is how it does it. Let's go in. Sometimes they'll say, you know what? It's too early for me. I'm not ready for that. But at some point, they'll get this.
So, for this too, how much capital have you guys raised to date?
Close to 70 million.
Obviously now, with all those exits, and all those big numbers of success, under your back, on your back, it's saying investors probably throwing money at you. How did you go about filtering the right people for the right reasons here?
It's if you take a look at the employee list in Salto, you'll see a lot of employees from Revelo, from previous ones. So we kind of tried, once you learn how to work with someone like the relationship I had with Vinny, you try to maintain the relationship. So some of our investors are our old investors like Bessemer, some are new ones, but by and large, I know what to look for in an investor. So it's something that you kind of grow into. Huh. The way to look at it is try to imagine a board relationship. A board relationship can be stressful, but you want to be in the right, in the room with the right people to make the right decision and not just appease the other side. So that's how I pick them up or how we pick each other up because that's what they're looking for as well. So it's a combination of old investors and new investors that we kind of learn as we go along. So that's how we pick them up.
So obviously, like when it comes to raising money, it's all about the vision, no? So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Rami, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Salto is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Huh. It's a world without work for me. It's a world where you can actually take a look at your SaaS portfolio and know exactly what's going on. I keep quoting one of the CIO I went to in the beginning, kind of when we started, when he only had a slide deck. So that is interesting. This guy was in charge. He was a big gaming company. He was in charge of the DevOps, of the actual application and the SaaS. He said, with my DevOps, I feel like I'm ready for 2050. Everything, I know exactly what's going on. I know, you know, the rate, everything will go in. I'm like a machine. With my SaaS application, I feel like I'm in the 90s. I know nothing. I don't sleep at night. Everything can break tomorrow and I will have no idea what's going on. So the world where the vision of Sado is there, this is like copy what happened to IT, like in the early 2000s, bring it here. That's reality. You know, having be able to do any change that you want in a way that, you know, even if you make a mistake, yeah, that's okay. That's the world.
That looks like a beautiful world to me. So now let's talk about the past and doing so with a lens of reflection, because obviously, you know, you've had quite the successful journey, the successful path, and a lot of lessons learned, I'm sure, all along the way, because it's not a straight line, as we all know. Now, imagine I put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, to that moment where you were graduating, you know, with your software degree. And before jumping into the venture world, let's say you were able to go right there and showing up and giving that younger Rami one piece of advice before launching a business and why. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, there's two things I think that are important. One, and I apologize in advance, it's a little bit of cliches, but it's the kernel there is true. So as a startup, you're in a disadvantage. You have less people, less money, no routes to market. So the only thing that you have that is better than the big guys is your ability to make changes. If you forgo that, if you're not making the changes, evolving your idea to actually meet the market, it's you're losing your only advantages. You're kind of playing the big guys game without anything. So you lose. And being able to constantly change, evolve your idea is not easy, because it means you have to admit mistakes. You have to admit this is wrong. You have to go to people that worked like a few nights without sleep to make something work and tell them, hey, you know what? This is not important anymore. Let's do this instead. So that's a constant thing. You have to keep doing that. If you do that correctly, you should avoid thrashing, obviously, because thrashing is a mistake. If you do that correctly, you have a much better, you know, odds of success. That's number one. And number two, as I told you about the engineers, I think it was in Kubernetes, I recruit the best engineers and people that I can find. I'm not compromising on anything. So if I have that brain power out there and I'm not using it, it's a problem. So using it, you have to give them all the information. So through the years, through the companies, what we developed is a culture of kind of brutal transparency. Every meeting with a customer, every meeting internally, everything is transcribed. Put on an internal tool that everybody can see. What I expect people to do is make yourself in kind of go through the information. And if you want to tell me that I'm wrong, based it on what you see, obviously I have no kind of knowledge that came from ancient time. I'm as smart as you, maybe less so. Tell me that I'm wrong. I'd love for you to tell me that I'm wrong. Show me that and make a change. But in order to do that, I have to be transparent with them and give them all information. The kind of the instinct of founders in the beginning, early kind of young founders, is kind of keep all information to themselves, because part of the information are things that are not going well. The startup, 90% of the things that are happening are not going well because it's an uphill battle. If you kind of keep it to yourself and not share that information, you're not harnessing the brain power that you have out there. You're missing on 80% of the value you can get from it. So that is it.
I love it, Rami. Thank you for sharing that. Very profound. For the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
LinkedIn, probably. Rami Tamir, LinkedIn, reach out. I'm always accepting invites.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, Rami, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts, or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.